everybody knows that Earth revolves around the sun. Everybody, except, of course, the people at the Government of Canada Weather Office, whose website announced authoritatively this morning that in Hamilton the sun rose at 6.04 a.m. and will set this evening at 8.49 p.m. But really, we do all know that Earth both rotates on its own axis and revolves annually around the sun, and we all know, sort of, or have been taught, that at some point centuries ago there was some kind of revolution in how we humans looked at the heavens and understood the relative movements of the Earth, the sun, the planets, and the stars. We've all heard about something called the scientific revolution, or the cosmological revolution, or perhaps the Copernican revolution. And at least popularly, we think of that revolution as marking a watershed between the end of the medieval world and the beginning of the modern world. I'm not here to deny the claim that the Copernican revolution marked a big shift in how we humans look at the world, but I would like to ask in just what respect our cosmic worldview changed, or might still change if it hasn't done so already. So let's start by looking at this schematic of the universe by Peter Apian that appeared a number of times in the 16th century, so roughly between 400 and 500 years ago. And please remember that nobody ever considered this depiction to be to scale. As you can see, right in the center are the Aristotelian elements, earth and water, surrounded first by air. You can see the sort of stylistic clouds followed by the sphere of fire. Those are the four Aristotelian elements. Well, actually, Aristotle adds the fifth, which is ether, and everything above that level is ethereal, literally ethereal, made of ether. And the key boundary in this universe is created by the sphere of the moon, lunae. There's the sphere of the moon, and that's the main boundary in that universe. Below the sphere of the moon is the elemental world, the world of the four Aristotelian elements. This was also known as the sublunary sphere, or the sublunary world. Above it, quite logically, was the superlunary world of planets, including the sun, the stars, the crystalline sphere, the primum mobile, and as you can see if your Latin is fluent, the imperial, this is right around the edge, the imperial heaven, the dwelling place of God, and all the elect. Remember that bit. This model, in other words, depicts what one commentator has called a two-story universe. Accompanying this imagined physical structure of the universe was roughly a system of astronomy, usually named after the brilliant second century Greek-speaking Egyptian astronomer known as Ptolemy, hence Ptolemaic astronomy. But to hurry along, you also know that Copernicus showed up in the early 1500s, and he proposed a different cosmology. I'd meditate on his face, I like it, but I once put it up in a lecture, and there were some people in the back wondering if this was me dressed up. Anyway, so he proposed a new model, not because it was any better predicting astronomical positions and events. It wasn't. Its main selling feature, as far as Copernicus was concerned, was the harmony of the system, with the periods of the planets increasing in a monotonic progression, and the orbit of the Earth, the Orbis Magnus, there we are, familiar now, third rock from the sun, functioning as a mathematical baseline for understanding the movements of the other planets. Note how the periods of their revolutions are annotated. We've got 80 days, 9 months, 1 year, of course, 2 years, and so on, out toward the outer spheres. You probably know this, but it's easy to forget that before the time of Copernicus, Earth wasn't considered a planet at all. I've seen some major historians make this mistake, referring to the mid at all, because they didn't think it was a planet. Planet means wandering star. So here are the old model and the new model side by side, with the model of the universe proposed by Copernicus on the right and Ptolemy's again via Appian on the left. Notice how similar the two schematics are. Both the Ptolemaic and the Copernican models are made of circles drawn with compasses. Both have seven planets, if the moon is included. But Copernicus, to put it simply, simply exchanges the positions of the Earth and the Sun within the model. Of course, he keeps the moon with the Earth for perfectly good reasons, but I won't go into that today. And he exchanges the motion of the starry sphere for the motion of the Earth. However, because it's almost impossible to believe that Earth is moving, come on, be serious. Earth is, well, of course we know that it is, but it's very hard to believe, let alone moving in multiple ways. No more than about a dozen serious thinkers actually accepted Copernicus' cosmological proposal during the 16th century. In other words, until a good six decades after his death and the publication of his great work, The De Revolutionibus. And even then, it remained, for good scientific reasons, footnote, Danielson and Graney, Scientific American, February 2014, the case against Copernicus, a highly controversial proposition on through the following century until the time of Newton and beyond. However, there was another huge cosmological development that took place in the 16th century, more or less independent of the work of Copernicus. The development was precipitated by the appearance in the heavens of the new star of 1572, something we now call a supernova. You may have seen this chap's picture before. That's Tycho Brahe, the Danish astronomer, who was really the first person who did big science. He had a sort of NASA-like budget to work with, proportionate to the Danish national economy. And he was the first person who, he wasn't the first person to notice the 1572 supernova, but he did such a thorough job of describing the phenomenon that it came to be named after him. And one of the things he did was to try to measure the parallax of the supernova. And by, through these efforts, discovered that it was superlunary. Remember that border between the sphere of the moon and the other spheres. He discovered that the nova was superlunary, that novelty was taking place in the upper story of the universe. And this discovery was devastating to 2,000-year-old Aristotelian assumptions, according to which all change takes place in the sublunary realm, in the lower story of the universe, while no change takes place in the upper story, where everything is regular, orderly, and immutable. Evidence against this set of assumptions kept coming in over the next 50 years. They got really lucky and had two supernovae within 50 years of each other. And I'll return to a little bit of the evidence indicating change in the upper level of upper story of the universe. All I want to do for the moment is to emphasize how radically evidence of change in the heavens altered views of the universe as a whole. If, of course, one accepted that evidence. To give you an idea of the persistence of two-story thinking, that's S-T-O-R-E-Y, two-level thinking, I want to show you another picture, one you've no doubt seen at some point. It appears in just about every history of astronomy textbook. Here in my forthcoming book. It was produced by the English mathematician and astronomer Thomas Diggs. He also, in 1572 and 1573, observed and described what we now call Tycho's supernova. And then in 1576, Diggs published the first ever printed translation of parts of Copernicus' De Revolutionibus, and not, by the way, as a mere proposal or hypothesis. He was a true Copernican. He was a realist Copernican. Published these translations as a description of the real world. And here's his famous graphic. And when we look at this picture, what most of us see, because we know that Diggs was a Copernican, we see Copernicus's heliocentric, sun-centered system, with the sun at the center and the planets ordered and labeled just as they are in Copernicus's De Revolutionibus. Perhaps the next thing we notice, though, is that unlike Copernicus, Diggs presents the stars not in a neat band of stellarum fixarum, fixed stars, but instead dispersed out off the edge of the page. As he puts it, in an orb of stars fixed infinitely up. One way to put this is to say that Diggs cuts and pastes the Copernican solar planetary model into the infinite sidereal realm of the ancient atomists. What I want to notice here, however, is a further bit of cutting and pasting. Let's zoom in on Diggs's graphic and take a look at our place in the universe. That's just a little cut from the picture you were just looking at. I think you've seen something like this before. There on the left is the same territory marked out in the Ptolemaic system as depicted by Peter Appian, with which we began. When we do zoom in on Diggs's picture, we realize that the old Aristotelian Ptolemaic globe of mortality, as Diggs calls it, is merely compacted and transposed earth, air, fire, and water into its new location in the Copernican system. Diggs, in effect, photoshops the familiar, if now pictorially miniaturized, sublunary world onto the recently enlarged picture of the superlunary cosmos offered by Copernicus. In doing so, Diggs avoids challenging something that most everybody in 1576 believed, that Earth and its environs were cosmically unique, not for their specialness, but for their infection with, that's the word I mean, their infection with change, mutability, mortality. So although Diggs was an avid Copernican, there are decided remnants of Aristotelian thinking, or at least vocabulary, in his work. One of the most notable examples of this is his description of Earth, which, in keeping with his Copernicanism, Diggs enthusiastically describes as a planet, a wandering star, and yet he calls it a little dark star. Because, of course, in the old Ptolemaic universe, light flowed inward but not outward from the Earth. 33 years later, in 1609, this chap, Galileo, started observing the heavens through his telescope and realized that Earth was not dark after all. It just gives me goosebumps to say this. I think this is one of the most decisive, as it were, poetically powerful realizations that Galileo arrived at. Earth is not a dark star. In Sidereus Nuncius of 1610, he discovered the phenomenon we know as Earthshine, by analogy with moonshine, moonlight, okay? I won't go there. For when he pointed his telescope at the moon, he realized that something was subtly illuminating its dark side, and that the illumination had to be created by sunlight reflected by the Earth, just as our moonlight is actually sunlight reflected by the moon. The cosmological implications of Earthshine are stunning. It entails, as Galileo recognized, a cosmos in which light travels a two-way street, which in turn weakens the bifurcation of the universe into two quantitatively different realms. In Galileo's words, it undermines the traditional belief that Earth must be excluded from the dance of the stars. For Earth does have motion. It surpasses the moon in brightness, and it is not the sump where the universe's filth and ephemera collect. That's Galileo, 1610. Let me remark in passing, I'm going to deprive you of visual aids for a minute. Let me remark in passing how contrary Galileo's claims are to the persistent modernist myth that the ancient and medieval geocentrism placed the Earth and humankind in a position of supreme importance in the universe. Some of you have heard me rant. In that older geocentric view, Earth was instead located in the center where heavy, gross things settle, and therefore occupying a place of disrepute, a kind of accordingly, what Copernicanism entailed was literally Earth's exaltation away from that place. Heliocentrism thus reconstrued Earth and the place of humankind as something dynamic and privileged rather than central and therefore low and ignoble. Depending on your point of view, then, Galileo either raised Earth to the level of the heavens or, more disturbingly, reduced the heavens to the level of the Earth. To cite just a few more examples, and I'm going to skip over some of these, geometry is what Galileo used to measure the height of the mountains on the moon. Geometry literally means earth measure, but now geometry was being used astronomically. It's what Samuel Edgerton calls the geometrization of astronomical space. And as you also know, Galileo, a few years later, discovered sunspots. One wag, contemporary with Galileo, said that with Galileo's Flemish glass, he has revealed filth on the cheeks of the sun. So in that sense, the sun was being brought down to a realm of mutability. It undermined the very assumptions of the two-story universe. Okay, part two. What do these developments in astronomy and cosmology have to do with theology, which is what brought you all here today? I mean, the topic of theology. What they do, I think, is to force a rethink of what we mean by heaven. Most of us are conscious of two quite different senses of heaven. The first is heaven as sky, simply the heavens, as in Genesis 1:1, in the beginning God created the heaven and the earth. That's presumably not the sense we have in mind when we pray, "Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven." Still, it's easy to get these two senses confused with each other. Look again at Diggs' graphic. The realm of the stars in all its boundlessness is identified as the place of felicity garnished with perpetual shining, glorious lights innumerable, far excelling our sun both in quantity and quality, the very court of celestial angels, devoid of grief and replenished with perfect endless joy, the habitacle for the elect. Heaven equals heaven, right? The heavens equal heaven. The theological problem created by the new cosmology becomes clear if we meditate for a moment longer on that key petition from the Lord's Prayer, "Thy will be done in earth as it is in heaven." Both the Koine and the Vulgate of this phrase place heaven first. Hos en urano kai epi eis, or sicut in kailo et in terra. My Latin is marginally better than my Greek. They're both very bad. Heaven in each of these phrases is placed first. So a kind of more literal translation would be, as in heaven, so on earth. The prayer is that earth should become more like heaven. However, unless one is very careful to keep the senses of heaven distinct, the heaven of the Lord's Prayer, meaning the transcendent realm of God, rather than merely the sky, the heavens above. The cosmological revolution of the 16th and 17th centuries could be seen to militate against the order of values implied by that petition. In short, it could suggest not earth becoming more like heaven, but instead heaven or the heavens being much more like earth than anyone had previously guessed. Some commentators have suggested that the cosmological revolution has deeply grasped affinities between earth and the heavens can accordingly be read as a desacralization of the heavens. I put it the other way around. Galileo and others' extension of earthly qualities of generation and vitality outward into a newly conceived universe implies instead a sacralization of the earth. For in the new cosmology, earth is indeed a star, albeit a wandering one, a planet possessing stellar nobility. The new understanding that arose from evidence of celestial alterations, mutations, and generations, I'm echoing Galileo, did not require that the heavens now be considered ignoble. However, it did imply that Earth's mutability could no longer be taken as evidence of its ignobility. We can press this logic still further. Mutability is not only universal, but also in significant respects superior. Superior to immutability. What, after all, is so desirable about things that are impassable, immutable, inalterable? And so I'm going to go to a single quotation from the Dialogo, the 1632 dialogue. Sagredo, in this dialogue, is a kind of objective middleman between Simplicio, who's the Aristotelian, and Salviati, who's kind of Galileo's spokesperson. And this is kind of the new valuation of the Earth that comes out of this Galileo's version of Copernicanism. I consider the Earth very noble and admirable precisely because of the diverse alterations, changes, generations, etc., that occur in it incessantly. If not being subject to any changes, it were a vast desert of sand or a mountain of jasper, or if at the same time of the flood, of the waters which covered it had frozen and had remained an enormous globe of ice where nothing had ever was ever born or ever altered or changed, I should deem it a useless lump in the universe. This is exactly the difference between a living animal and a dead one. Between a living animal and a dead one, or between a living and a dead creature, to use a different translation. So Simplicio, the Aristotelian, replies that the heavenly bodies do not need to change. And in response to that, Sagredo says, the heavens being dead are like a statue. What are the interactions between the heavens and the earth in this new cosmology, or in the old cosmology? It's like putting a statue and lying the statue down next to a real live living woman and expecting children to result from that union. Kind of audacious thought experiment. And that audacious analogy of the woman and the marble statue echoes vividly the earlier dismissal of the contrast between earthly change and celestial immutability as something amounting to the difference between a living and a dead creature. And it graphically implies a new cosmology in which things of Earth are projected outward into the universe. Change, generation, life, fertility, sex, maybe ET. How do these possible implications for the heavens affect our understanding of the heaven that is twice mentioned in the Lord's Prayer and elsewhere? I'm very sorry that I can't offer you firm or specific conclusions about how Christians today must conceive of heaven. I offer merely this challenge, and with this I conclude. Let's make sure we distance our theological conception of heaven and the eternal presence of God from the non-dynamic, everlastingly perfect, but ultimately dead heavens of Aristotelian cosmology. And while we're at it, let's value this stellar blue-green planet of ours as something to cherish and protect in keeping with God's will, not merely something to be left behind or discarded. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dennis. We've had 5 minutes for comments and discussion.
Bethany, so nice to see you.
So nice to see you too. What I was wondering is whether a similar shift was either introduced then or maybe ought to be introduced now in terms of going from the changeless as the perfect to the changing being the good.
Yeah.
In terms of the essential attributes of God.
Yes.
In terms of the immutability of God, this sort of very restrictive.
I sort of wondered, I mean, this natural question come up. So do we move from earthly change, evolution, to cosmic evolution? Well, we do in cosmology. Do we go past the next boundary to God? I'm not personally a process theologian, but I get the connection, and you're probably a better person to answer that than I am.
This paradigm here.
I rather think it is because because, I mean, if we look at it in terms of the history of how we read scripture, if not that everybody did, but if we read scripture as kind of setting things up the way they are now, a kind of uniformitarian model, that as our time frame gets longer and we become more aware of strata in the earth, those changes that have taken place on earth, and as we realize that the universe is expanding, to mention just one of many, many changes, it seems to me that they are of a piece. That's about all I can say. A really plausible point, and when you look at the parallels between biological evolution, thinking about biological evolution, and thinking about cosmological evolution, I mean, Herschel sets up his in his realm of the nebulae. He sees the nebulae as being gardens at different stages of development. So the biological cosmological analogy is really serious. Yes. They're all pretty much connected, literally or in some metaphorical way, with the actual up there.
So your point is still valid, but I would go to this was Neoplatonism to make that point.
And nor am I peddling Neoplatonism.
I'm curious, just because the scientific revolution is usually seen as a de-animation of the heavens with the souls of planets going away.
Yeah.
And you're presenting this as some way an animation.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think a lot of our popular understanding of the history of astronomy is backward. I don't think it's a desacralization of the heaven. I think it's, maybe there's a bit of movement on both sides of the boundary between the upper story and the lower story, because, once you've got all of these things with divine names like Jupiter and Saturn being planets in some sense like the Earth, maybe it becomes more, it brings it down to Earth somewhat, but it also brings the Earth, I mean, the declaration that Earth was a planet was seen as being uppity and impious, because we were ascribing that kind of semi-divine planetary status to something that for 2,000 years and more had been considered the pits of the universe. So there's movement on both sides, and there's nothing really absolutely unambiguous. There's no sort of clear answer to the question.
I just say, at the moment we're running into a slight problem in the computer. So while we can't yet get started on the questions,
and then it's another universe in which bad news for some is good news for others.
Cosmological story thing. I think it's much more likely that it's influenced by same term earlier about the economy of nature.
Interesting.
Economy
yeah,
nature.
Yeah.
And of course, he's reading Malthus on the economy of man. And in those analogies, you don't have fixity. You have interactions between organisms. And in the British, economic situation, there's this dynamic interaction that are being mediated by this impersonal market that out of the fact that there is no one place in this economic interaction that's fixed. It's constantly mutable. It's much more likely to come from there than from astronomical stuff that's basically not mutable.
Yeah, I would see the stronger influence actually being in the other direction. Darwinian biology influencing cosmological thought. In the example of the Darwin's son, who came up with theories about the existence and motion of the moon, trying to extend his father's principles into the realm of astrophysics.
Yeah, right. The notion of a mutable heaven with a history.
Yes.
Comes after the notion of a mutable biological situation.
Yeah, very good. I'm with you. Thanks for that.